Dan really likes wine this week. I think I have met a kindred spirit, and more so than usual on this show, because when my long-suffering wife is asked, Dee, what does your husband actually do? Her standard answer, and she's a lawyer, so she can come up with many things, is, well, he drinks wine and he plays golf. And I think that's a wonderful job description that also applies to my guest today. He does a little more than that because he's a key figure across many, many platforms in wine in America. TJ Douglas, lovely to have you here as a fellow wine drinker and golfer.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here at Cape Wine with you.
The smiles of all the guests that we've had coming into the show has been broad. And I think that speaks to a combination of South African hospitality, great South African wine, the sunshine and beauty of South Africa. Very broadly speaking, what's your take been on the visit to South Africa thus far?
Well, so this is my fourth trip to South Africa. A bucket list item that we handled really quickly in our lives is that my wife and I came here for our honeymoon in 2004. And this is my fourth time back, but this is my first wine time back. So I hit it from such a working kind of level right now, which is why my voice sounds like this. But what a lovely experience. The people are so welcoming. Everything from the food to the music to the sound to the vibes to the color. It's awesome. I love it.
And you are arriving here as somebody who's got such a rich history in food and wine. And the general theme of pretty much every guest we have on this show, not being a sommelier or a winemaker, is, well, I kind of got into wine accidentally.
Yeah.
And it seems to be something that's driven by passion and by interest. And you suddenly discover, hang on, it's even more than that. What was your journey into the world of wine?
Yeah, so the really quick backstory is I started off as a dishwasher when I was 14 years old to two things, help my mom pay rent and take girls out to mini golf and buy baseball cards. That was why I got into the hospitality side. And then fast forward, I ended up moving to Boston, Massachusetts from Vermont, where I grew up. And I ended up being a bartender, not a mixologist. There was no smoke or gelatin. You know, it was Cosmos and Espresso's the first time they were famous. And I ended up getting a job after years of bartending for a celebrity chef in Boston, Todd English. And I was the bar manager there right before opening. I wasn't the buyer, I was just the bar manager. The day before we opened, our full liquor license, which would have allowed us to drink, you know, sell whiskey and vodka, which is the things that I knew, it went to a beer and wine license. And so day one, I had this old school cuvée system behind me. And literally, in order for me to make my rent, I needed to learn about what I was selling. So I started tasting, going to a lot of bottle shops in Boston, asking sales reps to just teach me and just absorb everything. And I ended up taking it's really like more of an adult continuing education course at Boston University's wine school in Boston, Massachusetts. And I fell in love with it. And I was good at it, but it gave me an opportunity to learn something, but also to have honest enthusiasm about it. And that's, you know, that was a long time ago, and here I am now with you.
It's a career born of necessity, but
out of
one
necessity.
Which you clearly very quickly found
yeah.
something that you were very close to.
Yeah.
Was there a moment, was there a bottle, was there a glass where a penny dropped or a light went on? You thought, hang on, I think I've found where I need to be.
Yeah. Two moments, actually. The one was in that restaurant. And for any of your listeners who's ever traveled to Boston, there's an area called Faneuil Hall. So like Bostonians don't go there because it's like super touristy, but just like the foot traffic there. And it was amazing because the first wine that I went, oh, I didn't know that they can use two different grape ingredients to make one wine was a Bourgogne Pasto Grande. And so there's that. But then my aha moment, which I think is probably security passwords on a lot of my apps, is 1999 Sandroni Barbera d'Alba. And there was a woman, Kat Saleri, in Boston, a famous sommelier. And I was young. I was probably 23 years old, 24 years old. And everything, Dan, that she was talking about in terms of tactile sensation, in terms of aromatics, in terms of flavor, I was like, oh, I totally get that. I feel that. I taste that. I smell that. And that was my aha moment. It was my first six pack of wine that I ever bought to start my wine cellar in a closet next to the toilet paper, the Swiffer duster. And there's my six pack of 99 Sandroni Barbera d'Alba.
We were out filming not that long ago at La Motte, one of the estates in Franschhoek, and that will always be an estate that's special to me because when I was at university in Cape Town, having come down from Zimbabwe, I spent a substantial chunk, I hope my mum's not listening, substantial chunk of my book allocation from my university bursary on wine from La Motte, their Millennium and their Cabernet Sauvignon. And so forevermore, that will have a link to me. And I think you've discovered and explained exactly how we have a link to those wines that are part of our formative time. And I'd imagine that's guided a lot of what you do now, understanding that it's not just what's inside the bottle. In fact, it often isn't much of what's inside the bottle. It's the story around and it's how we forge an emotional connection with the wine that we fall in love with.
I agree with that, but I want to back up for one moment. Necessity turns into justification, doesn't it? Like for your own purposes.
It does indeed.
So, with more than the bottle, for me as a wine seller now for the Urban Grape in Boston, it's more about the story. It's the why. Why is the most important person, which is the customer. None of us would have, you know, jobs if there weren't the consumers out there, is to hear the story, right? The last part of it is the price or even like the cépage of the bottle, right? It's more about what can connect what's in this glass to this person's experience and make that experience even better. And it has nothing to do with price. And frankly, it doesn't have that much to do with source of origin, unless that source of origin makes the story and the why so much that more spectacular.
You have in Urban Grape, one of the great homes of wine in Boston. I think for those of us who see Boston through the lens of the international media, you have baseball teams, you have half of Ireland living there, and you have lots of lawyers. There is obviously far more to one of the great American cities. What is the wine culture, the wine world like in your part of America?
You know what? It's interesting. There's a lot of changes, right, where people will be focused on more of I'm going to use my air quotes here, the classics, right? The more of the Bordeaux, the Burgundy, even getting into the central and northwestern Italy. And then people go really far right and are focusing on Pet Nats and Carbonic and this. And there's trying to get this like interesting balance of like, you can have everything. It doesn't have to be one or the other, but we have some of the best chefs in the country. We have some of the best, I say wine drinkers, not drinkers of alcohol, but people that understand. And this is what I see here in South Africa, is that people appreciate service and people appreciate the story, but people appreciate good food and a good glass of wine. And so that makes selling wine in Boston, pairing wine with food in Boston a little bit easier, because that consumer is so focused on receiving what you're trying to give to them. And everyone's looking for a good experience, and Boston's great for that. And you forgot the best sports team of all time, besides, I guess, the Bucks, right? The Celtics. This is going to be a tough season, but next year, I'm telling you.
I love coming over to America. I spent a lot of time there last year and got to visit many different parts of the country. And I found a lot of wine. Granted, I was looking for wine, but I didn't always find South African wine. Mm. It was sometimes a bit of a struggle. And then there's that streak of delight when you find something from home and you're able to pour a glass. We face some challenges with taking South African wine to America at the moment. But by and large, is there in Boston an understanding of South African wine, an interest in South African wine? Are people willing to give it a go and hopefully be pleasantly surprised by what they find?
If you make your way past the Urban Grape, or to our website, theurbangrape.shop. If you end up coming there, yes, South African wine is widely accepted, sought out. The thing is, in Boston, again, the South African distributors, they also sell French wine and Spanish wine and a lot of wines from Iberian area. And so I think restaurateurs look towards South African wine, but like specifically more Chenin, right? Because if you're going by grape varietal, South African Chenin, in theory and in general, is going to be much cheaper than, you know, Malouis or Loire, right? In the Loire Valley or like Vouvray. And so I think people go for the dollar and the value and the return on the investment on there. But that doesn't mean that the story is being told. Now, in the big grocers, I think it's a lot of the larger brands. But at the Urban Grape, I'm one of the number one sellers of South African wine in Massachusetts. And my store is only 2,300 square feet because it's intentional. I taste it. I have the story. My staff loves it. We've met a lot of the people. I see that there's a really fun bottle in front of us, and I've been able to welcome him to my home in Boston and taste and drink from my cellar and talk to our guests. And, you know, with South African wine, and I'm sure we'll talk about, you know, this ridiculous, you know, 30-point tariffs. Even with 30 points, South Africa brings so much more value with the strength of the U.S. dollar than most wines from around the world. And so it's one of the reasons why I came here, just to expand my knowledge and build my own personal network so that I can bring the stories back and help be a good ambassador for wines of South Africa in the United States.
Well, based on that, I was on the phone a little earlier this morning to South Africa's Minister of Home Affairs, and we actually have a South African passport for you, and citizenship is sorted out because you've been such a wonderful champion of South African wine.
Oh, man, my wife's going to be very happy. She said, do not come back with not finding a way to move there.
We would happily, happily have you. The wine that you celebrate from South Africa is wine that faces a lot of competition, whether there is a, based on when. When the podcast comes out, 10, 15, 30, 7,000% tariffs. We never know what's going to happen at the moment. It's a crazy world in that sense. But tariffs or not, there is so much competition. We've mentioned this with other guests from America, where not only do you have the old world and its history of Europe, you have the geographic proximity of an Argentina or a Chile, but you also have now every single state in America producing wine. And Americans, like South Africans, are a patriotic lot. And I found so much American wine that I enjoyed when I was over last year from different parts of the country, from unexpected parts of the country. And I love to see that because it's always exciting to see new wine develop. It gives a bit more competition, certainly, to South African wine. But what is your sense of the evolution of domestic production, both in terms of the quality, caliber, excitement, but also Americans reacting to that and embracing it?
It becomes very kind of old school and non-American to be focused on the regionality, right? So when I think about everywhere kind of outside of the United States, they make wine to go with their food, right? So like you look at places in, you know, Italy, and I've told the story 100 times, 1,000 times, but I can't remember what town it is. But let's say it's between Florence and Siena. And back in the day, there was a toll road that the Pope, you know, taxed salt. So on one side of that road, they don't use salt in their bread, right? The Chianti Colizinesis taste different than the Chianti Colli Florentines because on that side, they use salt. And that regionality of growing grapes to make a finished product to go with the livestock that you raise, the veggies, the fruits that you grow, the way that you cook, it doesn't really happen in wine country, the traditional wine country, which is, you know, California, Oregon, Washington. But now what you're starting to see is the revitalization of Virginian wine starting to come up and going a little bit more food focused. You're seeing wines from Texas, really fun wines from Texas, right? Texas has some great barbecue. So a lot of those wines are starting to be focused more on the food pairings, right? And that's something I find is new, right? Like I love Napa Cabernet, but they're not, you know, growing the steak on Howell Mountain, you know? And yes, you can grow steak in the United States. It's one of these amazing tricks that we have. So I think you're starting to see some more of the regionality focus where wine and food marry with each other, and which is new. So I think that having other places outside of just California, which I love, it gets people in the wine tourism for people to travel around our own country, see the different cultures within the United States. And what a great way to learn someone's culture than with a glass of wine and some food.
There is no better. My first port of call any country I go to is a restaurant where I can find a dish that I don't recognize and a wine that I don't know, a little bit of guidance from the sommelier of the restaurant. And that's a space with which you are so familiar that you even wrote a book about it.
We wrote a book.
Because that's, again, this long and exciting story that you've had. Tell me about the book, what inspired it, and what story you were hoping to tell.
Yeah, well, I'll start off by saying that my wife, Hadley, is my wife and mom of my kids, but also my business partner. But we really try, it's tough as entrepreneurs, but we really try to separate church from state. And so
good luck with that.
Oh, I'd say we try, you know, it's, we're still working on it, but it's, we're still together and the business is still is going well. So Hadley runs all the communications and the marketing and the visuals for the company. And I, you know, manage the programs and stuff like that. So she puts it brilliantly that she sells the store and I sell what's in it. So prefacing your question or my answer to your question about the book, it's 100% of my information and 100% of her writing. So I am a co-author to her book, but it came out in 2017. It's called Drink Progressively. And the idea behind Drink Progressively is my goal is to really help take the intimidation out of wine, which will then create access for everyone and really make people understand that wine is for everyone. So years ago, when I ran a few restaurants, I wrote something called a progressive wine list, where we would taste the wines and based on their tactile sensation, their mouth feel, I would organize the wines from light bodied on the front palate to medium bodied to full bodied, because most food menus, no matter what type of food or cuisine it is and where you are in the world, if you're having a 2-3 course food experience, that first course typically is going to be light and bright, high acid, right? And then that second course, a little bit bigger. And then your final course is going to be more protein driven. And so it made it really easy for my servers, my staff, to sell wine to the most important person, the guest at the table. And that guest said, "How is this wine?" And the server says, "Oh, it's really good." We get that answer and there's no substance to that. And they're lying, right? So having this progressive wine list, they would say, "Well, sir, I haven't had this wine, but our wine program is designed that these wines go with these foods because." And so in the United States, it's 21 for legal alcohol consumption. And if you're in a restaurant and you have a lot of 19-year-olds that are in summer jobs, A, they probably don't drink wine. B, if they're probably not going to be able to pronounce Sauvignon, and you know, and C, they may not know where Bordeaux is on a map. And so you're not setting them up for success. And so if you can simplify wine by this feels like skim milk on your palate, you're going to be successful. Now, fast forward, when I didn't want to work 90 hours a week as a general manager in a restaurant anymore and a wine director, and I wanted to work 100 hours a week as a small business owner, we took that vertical progressive wine list and turned it horizontally. And I created the progressive scale, where we organize wines on a scale of 1 to 10 based on the initial mouthfeel. So we have the whites, the rosés, and the reds. And then we do low price and high price. And for your listeners, I'd love for them to check out the Urban Grape website, because I basically put wine on a spreadsheet. Left is light, right is heavy, bottom shelf is, you know, lower price. And that way people just shop based on their palate. And it takes the regionality and all of that fear of, I can't pronounce that, so I'm not comfortable spending money on it. But, oh, that's a pretty label. That's going to go great with my food. And it steps away from that. And so the book, Drink Progressively, was an opportunity to pair wine with food, but like normal food, right? Like I have a couple types of cheese in my fridge. What do I do with it? Or what's great for Chinese takeout, right? Nothing in there is sous vide. Nothing's crazy on that. And what it does, it allows people to understand their own palate, to become better drinkers, whether they can come into our physical space or not.
It is such an important distinction in wine education, which in itself, I think, is a term we don't always get 100% right, where it's not about dumbing down wine. It's about making it accessible and speaking to people in a language they understand, because G Wine's done a good job of making itself inaccessible to so many people over the years. And we see that kind of wine list a lot more now, but I know it was groundbreaking when you put that together, and we are beneficiaries thereof. So
thank you. I should have brought a book. I'll send one to you.
Please do. I shall add it very happily to my wine library. You've been great at introducing people to food and wine together. You've also been great at introducing people to the wines of South Africa, which brings us to a mutual friend, a guy who is a fellow Zimbabwean for me, and a man whose story most of our listeners have heard this many times. He's been on the show again quite recently, but Tinashe Nyamudoka, who crossed the border from Zimbabwe with a backpack and a few hopes and certainly no idea, aspiration or interest in wine, and and today stands as one of our great modern wine figures. And he is a combination of both a young black African who's made his way into a world that historically hasn't had many people like him in. Thankfully, it is changing relatively quickly. Mm-hmm. But he's very much a groundbreaker. He's got extraordinary work ethic. He's got a terrific story. And then fundamentally, he's making some very good wine.
Tinashe's amazing. And you didn't mention like his hat and like hoodie game. He has some really good branded clothing. I'm still waiting on my sweatshirt, Tinashe. So Kamusha, you know, rooted, right? You know, a South African immigrant from Zimbabwe. And he's making amazing wine, and we've supported him. We're one of the first people to really sell his wine and to really tell his story. And then you're like, wow, the wine's also really, really fantastic. He has a great stretch of varietals. One of our top selling wines, which is interesting because, you know, I don't know if it's South Africans' perception of what they feel that the Americans perceive South African wine as cheap, but it's because of the rand and the US dollar. But the number one wine that I sell from Tinashe is Flame Lily, which is his most expensive white. And we crush it. People love it. And if you love Condru or if you love California Sonoma style Chardonnay, that's the wine. And so being able to tell Tinashe's story, it's really wonderful. And he's had an opportunity to meet a lot of my clients as well.
I remember walking through the streets of DC, and my wife hates this. I walked past a wine store and there was a sign outside saying tasting. And I said, darling, they're just having a wine tasting. Shall we step in for a minute or two? And her face dropped because she knew that was the next 2 hours done with, and walked in and met the guys at Chats Liquor, who were very warm and very welcoming. But the moment they found out where I'm from, and you know Tinashe, he's been here, and suddenly just wine brought us together. And I'm often convinced, as I said to you a little earlier, that they're actually triplets, because one person cannot cover as much ground as he does. But he delivers this wonderful wine, and we're overdue having a glass of it. A wine that gives you not just all of those stories, but also the chance to give pinotage to your guests, to your audience. And again, a grape that for many is a little unfamiliar.
Yeah. Well, cheers.
Cheers.
Nothing like starting the day with a glass of Pinotage.
I think American time, it's just past midnight in Boston, so you're wrapping up a good night out.
So, you know, with his wines, and what's great about Tinashe, and I feel that for someone who owns a brand, right, he's a small business owner, you have to hustle and you have to be on the street and you gotta build it from the ground up. And being able to travel halfway around the world to do that, A, it's expensive in terms of money, but B, it's expensive with your time, right? Like you're leaving your family, you're leaving your friends, you're leaving the accounts that started you to go to another place to kind of build your brand. And he's, again, you know, one of his, you know, his three siblings or his two siblings is doing a really great job, because he's doing a wonderful job with his brand. And you're starting to see some of more of like the entry level wine starting to pop up in places like Whole Foods, right? And so for a small producer, and we're a small bottle shop, but for a small producer, having one or two of your lines in something where you can just, what we call moving boxes, right, where you can just crush that volume, that's great. But then coming into a bottle shop like the Urban Grape to actually tell the story and show his signature on my winemaker door and having people, you know, tag him on Instagram, it's just really wonderful. This wine is wonderful. This is lovely. I mean, the difference between tasting wine in a wine region with people that are used to wine, it's always the right temperature.
And it is so, so important. We don't always get it right in South Africa, because room temperature in Cape Town in summer versus room temperature in Bordeaux is a slightly different space. Yeah. But we are getting a lot better about it. And it's also part of this Pinotage story as we celebrate 100 years of a grape that's had its rocky times over the years, but is really starting to find a sense of identity. And in a lot of blind tastings where Pinotage was immediately identifiable, it's now a little harder for the right reasons, because it's created celebrating, certainly I feel, some really, really nice wines. So it is a great wine to be able to share with you. And not only because I know you know Tinashe, but the other element that speaks to who you are and what you do and your incredible wine journey, here is a young Black African right. who's made his way in. Your scholarships for young people of colour in America has afforded a really important opportunity to people who, in all likelihood, would not have had that opportunity otherwise.
Yeah, correct. And that was including myself. So for, you know, you can't see me, but I'm a Black American man. And, you know, coming up in the wine industry, I'm still one of the only, you know, wine shop owners, wine professionals that is a Black man in New England, right? And you know, Massachusetts is part of a couple other states in an area called New England. And it's not because of anything other than the wine industry doesn't reach out to a lot of those communities or those cultures. And so it was really in 2018 where I just got fed up where every time that I received an application from a person of color, it was always for a laboring position, right? A stocker, a delivery driver. And everywhere when I received an application for someone who's not a person of color, it was always for a sales position or a manager position, even if they didn't have any experience. Because as society puts it, they create their own level of self-worth. And so in order for me to change that, it starts with access. It starts with education. It starts with a network. And so in 2020, after the murder of George Floyd, a lot of people really focused, like, wait a second, Urban Grape, that actually is a Black-owned business. We were on the cover of the New York Times food and wine section asking how it was to be, and I make a joke, but it's not funny. I say, you know, they'll ask, like, how is it to be, you know, a Black wine, you know, a Black business owner? I'm like, well, I've been Black my entire life. I've been a business owner for 15 years. So, but now you see. So, but what that gave me, it gave me a spotlight, me and others in the United States, it gave us a spotlight to, you know, lift other people up. And so in 2020, we created the Urban Grape Wine Studies Award for students of color. And this actually, the program at the Elizabeth Bishop Wine School at Boston University's Met College was the same program that I took about 20 years earlier. And so we raised about $250,000 US, all by customers. Some were $5 donations, some were $5,000 donations. And what it does, it puts two people that identify as person of color, that are 21 plus because you're drinking, and they apply for this position. And if they do, they get 10 months of wine education at Boston University for free. And then that coincides with 4 3-month paid internships on all four sides of the wine industry that I've worked on. So they work at the Urban Grape for 3 months. They learn retail. They go to a distributor. They learn wholesale. They go to a restaurant. Not only do they learn service, but they learn how to create a beverage program. And then we've partnered with Jackson Family Wines over the last couple of vintages out in California. And so Jackson Family will take them for 3 months and teach them everything from farming to bottling to distribution to marketing, because it's JFW. And then they're coming out and they're getting like $85,000 to $100,000 a year careers. And it's not one guy became a SOM, but it's journalism, it's architecture, right? It's communications. Wine touches everything. And so we actually just started our 6th cohort.
That is such a fantastic story, TJ. You can be enormously proud of yourself about it. It's a really, really cool initiative. And I suspect it's one that's only going to grow because it speaks to so many of the values of wine. And I really love hearing that. So cheers to you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
And to your team. I can't leave you without one very important question. And that speaks to my initial introduction. In and amongst all of the wine, have you managed to sneak in a round of golf in one of the world's great homes of the game?
I've had an opportunity to lose a few balls. Yeah, totally. A couple of years ago, actually in 2020, it's been a busy four or five years, whatever year this is right now. And I was one of the co-founders of the Boston Black Golf Association and just gave a bunch of us just an opportunity to get out, you know, for 4 or 5 hours and just, like, you know, let our hair down and just kind of, you know, not have to worry about all the noise. And I really enjoy golf. It's my therapy. I'm not good at it. I'm now in the 90s, which I'm pretty excited about, but I really enjoy it. It gets me out there. And, you know, there's been a couple times where you'll find a magnum of something in that golf bag.
You sound like the golf partner I've always needed. Well, let's do this then. I don't need to invite you back to South Africa. So I think you'll be coming pretty soon anyway,
yes,
because you've clearly loved it. When you do come back, I would love to catch up with you again, play a bit of golf with you. And then also when I'm next out in America, Boston's one of the cities I haven't been to. And as someone born in Northern Ireland, I really should have spent some some time there. Yeah. The Urban Grape looks amazing. Tinashe speaks so highly of it. And you've clearly got a really special community around you. So it'd be wonderful to come out and see on the ground some of this terrific work you do across the world of wine.
Well, I look forward to welcoming you to my hometown, Boston.
And it leads me just to say, because I'm sure Hadley's listening, that TJ has been in bed 8 o'clock every night. He's only had one glass of wine. And in fact, yesterday I found him crying quietly in a corner while writing a poem about you. He's missed you terribly and his life is incomplete on this trip. All good still for those 9 wine bars later tonight?
Yes, sir.
TJ, it's been an absolute joy. Thank you so much. And thank you from South African Wine, because you're a wonderful champion of ours over in America. We need more people like you, but so does the industry. And I know that the work you're doing is only going to continue and grow, and we all benefit from that. So thank you.
Thank you.
So there we go, all the way from Boston. Boston royalty when it comes to the wine world. I'm not sure if we're raising a glass to taste the Celtics this year, but as long as what's in that glass is South African, we're very, very happy. One of our great friends of South African wine joining us on Dan Really Likes Wine.